All right, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Gives me very great pleasure to welcome you all and to welcome Professor David Harvey to lecture to us this evening. Professor David Harvey is currently a distinguished professor in the program of anthropology at the City University of New York Graduate Center. He's previously held a string of professorships, one in geography at Johns Hopkins University, another professorship in geography at Oxford in the late 80s and early 90s. He is the recipient of many prestigious awards. There's a very long list here, perhaps I won't mention them all, but you know, these are awards in geography, in urban studies. He won the Voutrin Lud International Prize for Geography in 1995, the Patrons Medal of the Royal Geographical Society in the same year, and on and on. He also holds honorary doctorates from the University of Buenos Aires in Argentina and various other universities, including Uppsala University in Sweden. He's written extensively in the field of urban studies, the political economy of globalization, the changing form of capitalism, urbanization, and cultural change. His work is critical, provocative, erudite. His publications include The Condition of Postmodernity, 1989, Justice, Nature, and the Geography of Difference, 1996, The Limits to Capital, 1999, and the two books which are on sale outside, The New Imperialism, Oxford University Press, 2003, and A Brief History of Neoliberalism, the latest book, 2005. And so, you know, this body of work adds up to an important critical intervention in helping us debate and understand the key trajectories of the contemporary world, and perhaps it can help us try to figure out ways in which we can create positive change. So without further ado, will you welcome Professor David Harvey for his lecture tonight.
I wrote the book on neoliberalism partly to remind myself where I had been over the last 30 years and what had happened over the last 30 years, and to think about some of the changes and transformations that had occurred. But I also wrote it because it seemed to me that many younger people needed to know something about the historical geography of how we got into our present condition and what it means to be in this condition. And I'm particularly interested in shifts of sentiments to the point where, in a sense, the two big markers I would put down in the book would be when Richard Nixon, as President of the United States, a very conservative figure, wrote into law, or signed into law, a whole raft of legislation dealing with occupational safety and health, with environmental protection, consumer protection, civil rights, voter rights, and all the rest of it. And he did so with a comment, "I guess we're all Keynesians now." And I wanted really to pose the question, the degree to which we have all become neoliberals now without really noticing it and without thinking about it. And in the process, to pose the question, how much of oppositional politics these days is actually cast in neoliberal terms? I'm thinking in particular on the rise of human rights discourses of various kinds, and also thinking of various other kinds of identity politics, and further thinking also of the rise of NGOs and civil society as the supposed locus of real political changes. In the process, I don't want to disparage or dismiss those loci of opposition, but I do want to pose the question, is there a way of opposing neoliberalism in other than neoliberal terms? Now, the rise of neoliberal thinking and its emergence into a position of hegemony has this long story attached to it, and I want to pay some attention to that story and to some of its roots. And one of its roots goes back a very, very long way. And I can best illustrate this, I think, by a little exercise I did recently, which was turned out to be more interesting than I imagined, which is going back and reading all of President Bush's speeches before 9/11 and after 9/11. And you find within those speeches a tremendous interest in ideas of liberty and freedom. They're constantly being referred to. And this was true before 9/11 and after 9/11 and continues to be very significant to this day. Here, for example, is what he said on the anniversary of the first anniversary of 9/11. He said, "We are determined to stand for the values that gave our nation its birth, because a peaceful world of growing freedom serves America's long-term interests, reflects enduring American ideals, and unites America's allies. Humanity," he says, "now holds in its hands the opportunity to further freedom's triumph over its age-old foes." And he went on to add that the United States welcomes its responsibility to lead in this great mission. Now, Tony Blair, when he came to Washington and addressed Congress, took exception, it seems to me, to some of Bush's language in that statement. Because what Tony Blair said was this: "There is a myth that though we love freedom, others don't, that our attachment to freedom is a product of our culture, that freedom, democracy, human rights, the rule of law are American values or Western values. Members of Congress, ours are not Western values, they are universal values of the human spirit." Bush actually accepted that amendment as a friendly amendment, because he then went on to say himself in a speech at the White Hall, he said, "The advance of freedom is the calling of our time. It is the calling of our country. From the 14 points," and he's referring to Woodrow Wilson, "to the four freedoms," he's referring to FDR, "to the speech at Westminster," given by Ronald Reagan, "America has put its power at the service of principle. We believe that liberty is the design of nature. We believe that liberty is the direction of history. We believe that human fulfillment and excellence come in the responsible exercise of liberty, and we believe that freedom we prize is not for us alone. It is the right and capacity of all mankind." Now, he took the argument one step further in a later speech as he accepted the nomination of the Republican National Convention. He said, "I believe America is called to lead the cause of freedom in a new century. I believe that millions in the Middle East plead in silence for their liberty. I believe that given the chance, they will embrace the most honorable form of government ever devised by man. I believe all these things because freedom is not America's gift to the world. It is the Almighty's gift to every man and woman in this world." And then in his inaugural speech, he used the word in his second inaugural speech, he used the words freedom and liberty something like just short of 50 times, saying, among other things, "Because history runs," he says, "we go forward with complete confidence in the eventual triumph of freedom, not because history runs on the wheels of inevitability. It is human choices that move events, not because we consider ourselves a chosen nation. God moves and chooses as he wills. While history has an ebb and flow of justice, it also has a visible direction set by liberty and the author of liberty." Now, there is in this, of course, an interesting transition from American values to universal values embedded in nature to the idea that, of course, since nature is a product of intelligent design, that freedom and liberty are the Almighty's wish. Now, this concept of freedom and liberty is laid out in the press and is laid out in the United States pantheon of ideologies as being absolutely critical to how people in the United States view the world. And for many people, however, it sits uneasily with the actual behaviors, with Abu Ghraib, with Guantanamo, with all of those other things. It sits very uneasily. But nevertheless, I think there is something here that is worthwhile looking at. And David Brooks, a conservative columnist for the New York Times, put it this way. He says, we must not assume that the real America is the money-grubbing, resource-wasting, TV-drenched, unreflected bimbo of the earth, and that all this high-toned language is just a cover for the quest for oil or the desire for riches, dominion, or war. He then went on to say that this rhetoric of freedom and liberty is real, significant, and important, and it defines a standard against which everything that Bush and his successors do will be judged. Now, I happen to think that Brooks' description of the United States as being a money-grubbing, resource-wasting, TV-drenched, unreflected bimbo, and all of this is just a cover for the quest for oil and desire for riches, dominion, or war, is correct. But I think he's also correct to go one step further and to say that this idea of liberty is significant. And I think the way we have to look at this is to look at the way in which Bush invoked a long tradition in American foreign policy, one that goes back to Woodrow Wilson and the 14 points. And of course, liberal theory looks upon Woodrow Wilson as being a great exemplar of a liberal idealist in international politics, somebody who failed to construct the League of Nations, who had an idealism for the world of self-determination and the like. But actually, you have to remember that Woodrow Wilson was also somebody who played a very important role in suppressing the Seattle general strike and in rounding up people and shipping them off to the Soviet Union and using the Attorney General's office to harass anarchists and socialists, put Eugene Debs in jail, and generally attacked all kind of union organizing. So this duality within America is very, very significant. FDR, same thing can be said for him, and of course we all know about Ronald Reagan. Now, nevertheless, this idea of freedom and liberty is significant for this connectivity back across the political spectrum. And my good colleague at CUNY Graduate Center, Neil Smith, in his book on the endgame of globalization, connects those dots very well when he talks about three phases of U.S. global search, or a search for global hegemony and domination. And those three phases were first Woodrow Wilson, second FDR and the founding of the United Nations, and now we are in what he calls the end game of that attempt to dominate through notions of freedom and liberty. Of course, Bush made a lot of his connectivity to Woodrow Wilson, and in his speeches does this again and again. For instance, he made a lot of the fact that he was the first U.S. president coming to Britain to stay in Buckingham Palace since Woodrow Wilson. And he then recounted in his speech how at a dinner hosted by King George V in 1918, Woodrow Wilson made a pledge. With typical American understatement, he vowed that right and justice would become the predominant controlling force in the world. And he then went on to say that we are sometimes faulted, he says, with the naive faith that liberty can change the world. If that's an error, he went on to say, it comes from reading too much John Locke and Adam Smith. The thought of Bush reading John Locke and Adam Smith does stretch the imagination quite a bit. But on the other hand, what we see here is a certain continuity in the American ideology about somehow or other the United States is a beacon of freedom and liberty, and that it will remain so forever, and that it therefore has a duty to try to spread freedom and liberty throughout the world. The difficulty of this argument, of course, is simply this, that the notion of what is freedom and liberty is itself a confusing notion. And what I did in the book was to start to talk about the distinction between the connectivity of freedom and liberty with a very, very narrow construction of freedom and liberty as given by private property rights, free markets, and free trade, which is the liberal version and continues in the neoliberal version, and the broader notion of freedom and liberty, which Polanyi sought to define by arguing that state interventions, state constructions could broaden the field of liberty rather than render it narrower. And of course, Polanyi made the argument, I think, which is very cogent and very important for our times, to say that the closer we get to this liberal utopian or neoliberal utopian dream, then the only way you can sustain that very narrow conception of what freedom and liberty is about is by having a state apparatus and a series of state apparatuses which are very much geared to authoritarianism of government of all kinds. Now, what Polanyi suggested was that the institution of a neoliberal, in his case a liberal order, but I think we can say the same thing of a neoliberal order, that the institution of it would likely create such huge inequalities that what we would end up with is, as he called it, freedom and liberty for a small elite, while the rest of us were left with a pittance, struggling to maintain a certain level of freedom and liberty through sadly eroded democratic institutions. Now, this argument over what is freedom, what is liberty, how can it be maximized, is something that desperately needs to be set forth. But there is very little actual discussion of that topic at this time. And it is in that sense, it seems to me, that even those who really work strongly with the idea of freedom and liberty, Amartya Sen, for example, still locates a certain degree of what that is about very strongly in the idea of functioning market forces, private property rights, and freedoms of trade, and those sorts of freedoms which are embedded in the neoliberal order. And it is that neoliberal tying together, which Hayek, Friedman, and all the others did in the late 1940s, the tying together of that idea of freedom and liberty as a general political principle with a certain kind of economic order, which is what has to be broken, and of course, which was a minority opinion in the 1950s and the 1960s. And therefore, one of the big issues is how did it become a majoritarian opinion, and in what ways did it become a majoritarian opinion? Now, here I want to go back to one of the examples I used in the book of the founding of one of the founding moments where this shift occurred, in which neoliberal opinion suddenly emerged as victorious in a particular political situation. And this goes back to the story of what happened in New York City in the fiscal crisis of 1975 to 1977. Now, I don't want to make it seem as if somehow or other neoliberalism just suddenly emerged. There have been many ideas and discussions and think tanks and so on which were working with neoliberal thinking right the way through the 1960s. And there were many elements which existed within the existing society which allowed neoliberalism to emerge as a hegemonic and dominant social order. And this goes back, I think, to something which is very important for me in terms of understanding revolutionary transformations. And that is the idea that revolutionary transformations never come from outside, they come from inside, that they come from within, and they pin together existing configurations of forces in new ways, and that therefore the birth of the new is not something that is entirely new, it pulls together elements which are already there. And this is what happened during the New York fiscal crisis. It is interesting that in 1975, when the investment bankers suddenly went on strike and refused to lend to New York City and forced the city close into bankruptcy and eventually took over the city budget, first through the Municipal Assistance Corporation and then through the Emergency Financial Control Board, essentially denying all democratic governance to New York City and regulating the budget as they saw fit, that this financial coup against democratically elected government of New York City was something which they had longed to do for a very long time but had never been able to do. But it was a fiscal crisis that enabled them to do it. And it was therefore the fiscal crisis that allowed them to start to restructure the New York City economy along completely different lines. And I make this point because again and again throughout the history of neoliberalization, we see a crucial role to crisis formation, even to the point where one wonders whether crises aren't deliberately orchestrated, deliberately manipulated as part and parcel of trying to retread and reorganize the economy. In other words, crisis is a vehicle, a means through which restructuring can be constructed. So the crisis then had various elements to it. What in effect happened in the crisis was a number of rules were set up as to how neoliberalization would actually work in practice. The rhetoric of neoliberalization about freedom and liberty and so on had always been there. The idea of getting government out of the way had always been there. Walter Wriston, who was at the time president of National City Bank and for whom you can thank his great innovation was the ATM, great neoliberal device for using money. Walter Wriston, for example, had long been on record as saying that Britain during the 1950s and 1960s was a crypto-communist economy. And as far as Walter Wriston was concerned, New York City was a denizen of communists who were essentially running the government. So Walter Wriston had long held those extreme right-wing views. But on the other hand, Walter Wriston, as head of New York City, the what became Citibank, also did business with New York City. And New York City business was good business. So that Walter Wriston was one of the key people who at various times urged New York City to start to engage in all kinds of funny financial practices during the 1960s in particular, in order to ensure that the debt of New York City became even more lucrative for the investment bankers. So that during the 1960s and 1970s, while Walter Wriston held these personal views about what he would like to do to New York City, he couldn't do anything of the sort because the political situation did not allow him to do it. And that when it came to the early 1970s, Walter Wriston and Citibank and all the financial institutions, for a brief period of about 2 or 3 years, were flush with immense amounts of surplus funds. And those surplus funds had to lend it to somebody. So they were lending to New York City like crazy. And in so doing, they were assuming that New York City would be able to pay off its debt. In 1973, there was a property crash. The property market crashed. It did so globally. And then there was the oil price hike, a recession, rising interest rates, and suddenly New York City found itself in a very difficult financial position. Such a difficult financial position that indeed the investment bankers started to fear for the fact that they had invested so much in the city. They sought to bail out, to get out of the city. One of the ways in which they did it, which you should all listen to very carefully, is before 1972 or 3, the New York bankers had passed on the debt. They underwrote the debt and then passed it on. And they passed it on only to wealthy investors, usually in denominations of $25,000, which at the time was a lot of money. So small investors could not get access to New York City debt. In 1973 and 1974, they suddenly said, small investors can get access to the debt. You can buy New York City debt in denominations as small as $10. So whenever anybody makes debt accessible to you, watch out, you're about to lose your shirt. Because that's what they were trying to do. They were trying to pass on the debt to a broader market than was existed before. Now, this debt financing scheme in New York City, which then came unstuck, created a situation in which the bankers, by taking over the city, were able to enforce upon the city the following rule, that all tax receipts from the city went first to pay them off, the bankers. And then after that, whatever was left over was there for the municipal budget, and the city could start to determine how that was spent. And that was the first round. That was before they took total control over the budget through the Emergency Financial Control Board. This meant that the city immediately had to lay off something like 2,000 firefighters, something like 5,000 police, 2,000 garbage workers, and the list went on and on. And at the same time, the demand was that the city start to charge user services for what it provided, healthcare, and in particular education. My own university, CUNY, was tuition-free up until this time, and the demand was that CUNY charge tuition from then on. Now, this budget and the budget cutbacks inflicted immense austerity upon the New York population. It meant huge cutback in public services, in education, healthcare, sanitation, police protection, and all the rest of it. And of course it meant considerable diminution of the standard of living for many of the population in New York City. And it established the rule, which then became a rule which Reagan used when he became president in the 1980s, and then established the rule which became the rule of structural adjustment programs of the IMF in the 1980s, which is this, that in the event of a conflict between the well-being of a population and the well-being of financial institutions, you choose the well-being of financial institutions. The population has to pay for indebtedness. Now, this is actually goes against neoliberal theory. Neoliberal theory says if lenders make a bad lend, then they should bear the brunt of what that's about. But what this means is that lenders could lend to whoever they like and they would always be bailed out. And that, of course, is what happened in the Mexican debt crisis subsequently in 1982, what happens with every structural adjustment program of the IMF. So this is a golden rule of neoliberalism and neoliberalization, which is financial integrity, the integrity of the financial system and of financial institutions comes first, and the well-being of the population comes second. But then something else occurred. The financial institutions had made a coup against New York City. It was a very, very effective coup. But the financial institutions had a particular difficulty in relationship to the city. And the difficulty was this, that they had a lot of investments in the city. In fact, part of the reason why New York City ran into bankruptcy was not because of profligate union contracts and all the rest of it, and there was some of that, no question. But one of the big questions during the 1960s and the 1970s was state support of the real estate boom. Remember, this was the time when the World Trade Center was built. And it was built with public monies. A vast amount of investment in New York City was supported by public monies. The debt crisis of New York City had as much to do with problems in the real estate market and problems that that the city had run into in supporting a lot of that activity as it did with the municipal unions. But the tale that was told in the press and everywhere else is the fault of the New York City crisis lies with the unions, not with the property developers, state apparatuses, and the like that had engaged in all manner of property speculation. The crash of the property market then had to be reversed because the values of all of those properties in Manhattan were of crucial importance to the investment bankers. And therefore, they faced the question, how are they going to revitalize New York City? Now, one of the stories I tell in the book is the way in which many institutions got together in the early 1970s to start to reorganize the U.S. economy, and in particular, to reorganize the New York City economy. Some people have suggested to me since that it makes it sound like a conspiracy. Capitalists are, of course, very capable of launching conspiracies. But in this instance, it was a plain, obvious political project. When Lewis Powell wrote this memo to the American Chamber of Commerce in 1971 saying, collectively we've got to get together and reestablish the legitimacy of corporate capitalism in America and the legitimacy and seriousness of the market process, he was asking for a collective, class-driven project to try to revitalize the economy in their particular way. When the investment bankers got together in New York City with the idea that they could restructure the U.S. economy, they rubbed their hands with New York economy, they rubbed their hands with glee and said, this is how we're going to do it. It was a moment of creative destruction. They destroyed old New York. They destroyed the working class institutions of old New York. They destroyed the public infrastructures of New York. But they needed to revitalize New York along neoliberal lines. How were they going to do it? Here we hit a number of very interesting kind of fortuitous elements. It had been the case in the 1960s that New York City had become very different, was beginning to emerge a different kind of attitude and atmosphere in the city. And this was, I think, most beautifully captured by a magazine called New York Magazine, which was a spin-off from the defunct Herald Tribune in the 1960s. And that was about lifestyle. And it talked about New York lifestyle. New York lifestyle was crucial. And during the late 1960s, early 1970s, it was promoting the idea of New York City as being a center of an emergent, different kind of lifestyle. The investment bankers got together with Wall Street and formed something called the Downtown Partnership and decided to launch a whole selling of New York City as a center of lifestyle. This is where they set out the I Love New York logo. That's where it came from. It came from that brilliant idea on the part of the Downtown Business Partnership. They wanted to turn New York City into a center of tourism. They wanted to turn it into a cultural center. In here they were also helped by a long-standing process. There's a great book about how New York stole the idea of modern art, which is about how in the Cold War period New York institutions took over the definition of modern art through the Museum of Modern Art in New York City, and in particular through the activities of Nelson Rockefeller, both governor and patron of the state at the time, and also patron of the Museum of Modern Art. And that therefore, this was a center of power, of determination of what is or is not good art, because this is where money power was being exercised in the art market. And on that point, there was an interesting kind of confluence, because the crash in the property market allowed aspiring artists to live in Soho, New York Soho, to engage in loft living, as Sharon Zukin calls it, and to engage in all kinds of innovative activities. And there's been a wave of nostalgia recently. And at the Tate Modern, there was an exhibition called Open Systems, which was about the 70s. And there's particular immense nostalgia in artistic circles for 1970s New York, when indeed property prices were so low you could live in Soho on almost nothing, and you could have all the access to all of these art institutions. No aspiring poor artist can afford to live in Soho anymore. They have to go and find some place out in Queens or Brooklyn if they want to be in the New York art scene at all. So the art scene suddenly became part and parcel of what New York was about, and tourism also. But in tourism, there was a very interesting kind of moment of resistance to this whole kind of selling of the city as a place to come and to be have a good time. And that was this, that on the one hand, you're reducing the lifestyle by cutting back on police and fire protection and all those other things, at the same time as you're trying to get people to come to the city. And the firefighters and the police realized they were onto something, because they launched a campaign called Fear City. They produced brochures. They went out to Kennedy Airport saying, don't go into Manhattan. If you go into Manhattan and you go on the subways, you'll certainly lose your wallet, if not your life. It's okay to travel the buses, but only during daylight hours. If, by the way, your hotel catches fire, then you better jump straight out the window, because there'll be no firefighters to... Well, this actually got back to Europe. So all over Europe, people were getting scared about going to New York City. And it scared the hell out of the bourgeoisie in Manhattan. So immediately what they did was they negotiated with the firefighters and the police, and they said, look, stop this campaign, and we will reintroduce. We will make special moves to bring back some of those positions we've cut. So they increased the number of firefighters, and they increased the number of police. But guess where they put them? They were all in Manhattan. None of them were in the Bronx. None of them were in the Queens. None of them were in Brooklyn. And so when there was this famous moment, when there was a baseball World Series game on and the cameras panned round from Yankee Stadium looking at the Bronx, and the fires were burning all over the Bronx, and they said, the Bronx is burning, because there were no firefighters to take care. This is the uneven geographical development of New York, that everything was being concentrated on Manhattan. And from then on, Manhattan was going to be the playground of the rich and the playground for tourists and the playground for cultural activities and the like. But at that very moment also, something else went on which allowed the investment bankers to start to do something else. And that something else occurred on the international scene, which is fascinating. Because in the international scene, as the OPEC oil price rise occurred, masses and masses of dollars were being assembled in the Middle East and Gulf states. And the big question was, what was going to happen to those dollars? Were they just going to sit there, or were they going to recirculate? How were they going to recirculate into the global economy? And who was going to be in charge of the recirculation? Well, we now know that the United States negotiated with the Saudis, in particular, to make sure that that money recirculated through the United States, and in particular that it went to the New York City bankers. Not only did they do that, but at the same time, they had apparently organized themselves to invade Saudi Arabia during that oil price hike with the idea of guaranteeing low price of oil for the future. They didn't do so. We know this, from British released Secret Service documents from that period. So it looks as if, and we have no direct connection, that the threat of invasion plus various other economic threats led the Saudis to say, okay, we'll put all that money back in New York City. And it led the other Gulf states to do the same. The result was that vast amounts of money flowed into New York to be reorganized and orchestrated through the global system. This posed a certain problem. And Walter Wriston again came into the picture and made the following kind of comment. It was clear that the investment opportunities during the recession in the United States were very low, were very weak, were very poor. So Walter Wriston took the view, well, we lend to states because states don't go away. So that's when they began to lend big time to developing countries like Mexico. And here we see the long trail beginning of debt financing of Mexico, which then crashed in 1982, and then a whole series of crashes in Mexico, each one of which led to a greater and greater round of neoliberalization. So there's no question, when you start to look back at the way in which forces were gathered together, that there was a political project to discipline the system and at the same time to reconstruct it along certain kinds of ways. And this reconstruction in New York City was very much about creating something called a good business climate. And that therefore it is absolutely crucial for a local state or the state in general to create a good business climate. And if there is a conflict between the well-being of a population and the creation of a good business climate, then you have a choice in which you choose the good business climate. And those are the two golden rules of actual neoliberalization, that the state is actually interventionist. It creates a good business climate. That is what it's supposed to do. It's not non-interventionist, as neoliberals claim it should be. It is highly interventionist. And it is highly interventionist to the point where it ends up, instead of subsidizing the delivery of services to the poor, which organizations like the Manhattan Institute continue to say is the main business of New York, it actually does so for corporate capital. And here's some data which just came out last week. For the first time, we have an idea of who gets subsidized in New York City. In New York City, subsidies to the tune of $48 million a year actually are pushed out to corporate capital. The most deserving of corporate capital is Chase Manhattan Bank, $8.7 million, Morgan Stanley, $8 million, National Broadcasting Company, $5 million, et cetera, et cetera, Pfizer, $2 million. Very deserving, obviously, of public largesse. And we then find that even the money that was given to New York City to help rebuild at the World Trade Center has gone in very peculiar directions. Several million of it have gone to subsidize the Bank of America's new building on 42nd Street. Now, 42nd Street is rather a long way from ground zero. But the general argument is, well, you know, there are spillover effects and spillover benefits, and so we're really interested in the whole of the New York economy, and so, you know, and we need them. Bank of America needs that. Chase Manhattan needs this annually. These are the kinds of things that are going on and have gone on ever since. Now, there is, within all of this, one tremendous central point. When we look back at the 1970s, particularly in the United States and New York, what you see is a coalition of forces emerging, a coalition of forces which brought together particularly the financiers and the heads of large corporations. The Business Roundtable, formed in the United States in 1972. The Business Roundtable comprised corporations which accounted for about half of US GDP at the time. The Business Roundtable became very involved in the New York fiscal crisis in the following way. It actually hired lots of people to write lots of, quote, independent opinion articles with respectable credentials, all of which went into that very left-wing journal, The Reader's Digest, explaining to everybody how much better you would be off in a university that charged tuition, how the quality of education would be so much better, how you would be much better off by paying tuition at CUNY. The Business Roundtable then paid for the reinsertion of every single one of these articles in all the college newspapers around the CUNY campus system. The CUNY campus system is very large. It has 225,000 students currently. It comprises many colleges: Hunter, Medgar-Evers, Queens, City College, Brooklyn, etc. And so the Business Roundtable was actively involved in the whole kind of tuition issue at CUNY, and used all of its power and all of its influence through the media and all of its contacts through various organizations to try to force CUNY into the tuition. And of course, the tuition thing was eventually lost. But again, in a very interesting way, one of the geniuses within the system was that they decided not only would they raise tuition, but they would also close the one black college in CUNY at the time, Medgar-Evers College. So there was a neat way in which you could pit class against race. And the race issue was won, Medgar-Evers College was saved, but the CUNY tuition issue was lost. The class issue was lost. Now, when you start to look at the characters involved in all of this, what you see is a narrow elite group, which is having tremendous effort during the 1970s, seizes the moment during the 1970s to implant its own particular vision of what the future will be. And it uses neoliberal rhetoric. It uses think tanks, all of those think tanks that got set up in the 1970s. I think, and of course, still very influential and still with us. Heritage Foundation, Manhattan Institute, all of those other think tanks which are there. In this country, the Adam Smith Institute, and so on. So what we have is an ideological onslaught in which you can start to say that ideological onslaught has behind it a tremendous amount of financial power. And that financial power was assembled by these particular groups, like the Business Roundtable, American Chamber of Commerce, National Association of Manufacturers, and the like, in a collective effort to try to redesign the economy. It even took that abroad. A famous figure abroad who's often referred to in kind of very positively in neoliberal circles is Hernando de Soto, whose ideas about, you know, give people assets and then they get much wealthier, give them title and they get much wealthier. And this is seen as something that comes from a developing country, i.e. Peru, because he's a native of Peru. He happens to have been born in Geneva, educated in Europe, and funded by a whole series of think tanks from the United States. And it's interesting. His ideas have been followed, and it's very difficult and very controversial to find out what the effects have been, because these are sort of experiments which are very difficult to monitor. The most excruciatingly interesting study, which is a very detailed study, which many people do give credit to, suggests that the only impact has not been that people have grown wealthier, but that they have worked longer hours outside of the home. And that the reason for this is quite simply because if you're a squatter, you have no title. If you're outside of your home a lot, somebody will come in and squat in your place and you have no recourse. But if you have title, then you have recourse. So that people spend more time working outside of their home, but they're no wealthier. So these are the kinds of ideological shifts which have been there. It has been a political project. And it's a political project, and this is, I think, the key point to understand, that has benefited only certain groups in the population. Every wave of neoliberalization has ended up creating billionaires all over the place. In the United States, we had a situation in the 1970s where the top 1% of income earners got about 8% of the national income. By 1999, before Bush and his crowd started changing all the taxation structures, they'd already doubled their share up to 16%. The same was true in this country. The top 1% of income earners have doubled their share of the national income over the last 20 years. In Mexico, within 5 years of the Salinas privatization wave, you find five Mexicans in the Forbes top billionaires club globally. Look what happened after market medicine, or whatever you want to call it, was given to the ex-Soviet Union. Soon, seven oligarchs were controlling a massive amount of the economy. China is an astonishing case, where the inequality has risen immensely over a short period of time. In other words, the neoliberal dream has been about the consolidation and reconstruction of class power. And that class power has become more and more significant over time. And what we see, for example, recent data, somebody did a calculation and said, how wealthy were the Forbes wealthiest 200 people in the United States in 1980, whereas how wealthy are they today? In constant dollar terms, on average, back in 1980, they had 680 million. Now they have 2.8 billion each. They've quadrupled their real wealth in that time. So what we've had is an immense concentration of wealth. We now have concentrations of wealth all around the world. And what you start to see when you look at the whole kind of story of what neoliberalization is about is again and again and again, it's this concentration of wealth, with there often being fall guys involved in the process, the IMF being one of the primary fall guys. In Argentina, for example, there's a tremendous blaming of the IMF for all of their troubles. Yes, the IMF is partially to blame, but also the political economic elite in Argentina is to blame. And one of the ways in which you mask the way in which a political economic elite has amassed immense resources in Argentina is to say it's all the fault of the IMF. And so Kirchner goes on a huge kind of thing against the IMF as part and parcel of keeping the eyes off where the money went internally. Neoliberalization, as it occurred in New York City, was about a local elite using all of the forces it could, internationally, nationally, and locally, to try to reconstruct the economy in a certain kind of way. And I think it's a useful model to use that in saying, but neoliberalization anywhere is going to be like that. That indeed external powers are invoked and brought into a situation, be it a local situation like a city or a whole economy like Argentina. But what you see here is that this process involves class formation, class consolidation, construction of class power, consolidation of that power. And here, of course, we come across one of the weird things. There are quite a few texts talking about neoliberalization around. What I found was suddenly unusual about mine was that I said it has something to do with class. It wasn't just sort of a natural evolution of the market economy or anything like that. It was a class project from the very beginning. In fact, it seemed to me crucial to say the following as conclusion, that we've lived through 30 years of fierce class struggle waged by a political economic elite in its own interests. It has used crises again and again and again to consolidate its interests. And those crises of neoliberalization, which have, the number of financial crises since 1980 is huge. Some countries have been in crisis four or five times, some twice in the same year. That crises become a vehicle for what neoliberalization is about. The irony, of course, is that neoliberalization has not done a very good job of restoring conditions of capital accumulation in general. What it has done is to create the conditions for a redistribution of wealth to this very, very narrow political economic elite. And in that, it has been superbly successful. And if you ask the question, well, how do you struggle against this? Can we struggle against it through a discourse of rights, through organizing NGOs and doing all those kinds of things? Well, that can indeed provide some sort of basis for struggle. But I guess I've come back to a very old-fashioned opinion. If it looks like class struggle, acts like class struggle, feels like class struggle, then why the hell don't we wage class struggle back? Thanks.
Indeed, Professor Harvey. And now we have, perhaps we'll just take 30 seconds if some people are leaving, but we now have some time for questions, so. Right. And a steward will come around with the microphone. And feel free to ask questions from the upper tier as well.
I just had a question really about rival philosophical conceptions of liberty. You mentioned Amartya Sen. I just wonder whether you have any view on sort of neo-Roman developments in this, particularly I'm thinking of the work of Philip Petty in terms of conceiving of liberty as non-domination rather than non-interference, whether that is a useful basis to start or whether it's a sort of mealy-mouthed redescription of something that Marxists have always talked about and therefore just obscures the task.
I think actually right now it would be very useful to lay out a whole set of arguments about, you know, freedom, liberty, what's meant by it, and I think I would welcome any kind of contribution to doing just that. So comment up.
Hi, hello. I'm not denying your allegations that the political elite has a huge impact on the development of institutions since the New York fiscal crisis. But you suggested that it might have been some kind of capitalist conspiracy. I'm just wondering that it kind of looked, the fiscal debt that New York City held looks like a private debt contract where if you don't pay up, then the creditor comes in and takes over all your assets, liquidates it, and takes what's left. And that's what a private debt contract is. I was just wondering whether you thought that debt issued to states should therefore look different to private debt, and what the impact will have on lending, because people are not going to lend to a state if, on default, they don't get anything back.
Well, there are two things there. First, by the standard you're talking about, New York City would have defaulted back in the 1960s. But what happened was the bankers, some of the very conservative figures who later on really attacked New York City violently in the 1970s, encouraged New York to find new ways of playing with its debt. For instance, they went to something called revenue anticipation notes and tax anticipation notes, in which New York City could issue debt based on the future tax revenues, you know. So there's all kinds of gimmicks in there. The Constitution of New York City says the current account should be in balance always. You can, however, go into deficit, long-term deficit, for capital account things like, you know, sewage, new sewage systems or something of that kind. So what they started to do was they started to issue long-term debt bonds and then take some of the money and put it into the... I mean, there were all kinds of practices that went on in this way, which was all encouraged by the bankers. And sorts of things that you and I would never get away with in private debt. And the point here is that a jurisdiction doesn't go away like a corporation or even like a household. A jurisdiction like New York City is, and as Walter Wriston kind of said about governments, they don't go away. You always know where they are. You can always go get them. You know, I mean, they just can't disappear. They can't declare bankruptcy and disappear. They're always there. So the interesting question then is how is, you know, in that circumstance, how is debt sort of organized? Now,
In Argentina, of course, recently what they've done is they've offered to pay something like 25 or 30 cents on the dollar for debt. Now, this is something that was a sort of thing that was offered in the late 1980s under the what was called the Brady Plan. When the Brady Plan said, well, for countries that can't pay their debt off, what we will do is we will issue new debt in which they only have to pay 65% or 67%, I've forgotten exactly what it was, something like that, of their debt. And they get these new bonds, and they're now indebted for 65%. So in a sense, the banks are going to lose a certain amount, but at the same time, the Treasury was going to pay the banks off. So the banks were getting 65% of it all. So one of the big questions arises, however, as to, in a crisis of the New York City sort, what should be the mutual bearing of the cost? Should it be the lender who also, and after all, if you lend to somebody and they don't have any money, they just declare bankruptcy, then, you know, you've lost your money. So what should the lender bear? In New York fiscal crisis, the answer of the investment bankers was nothing. They paid nothing, effectively. And they went to all kinds of means to dispose of their debt. For instance, one of the things they legislated, which is an interesting thing, was they legislated that all the pension funds of the city workers should be invested in New York City debt. So this allowed them to transfer the debt from themselves to the New York City pension funds of the workers, which then put the workers in a very interesting situation. If you push too hard on contract negotiations and you push the city into bankruptcy, then you lose your pensions. I mean, this was the sort of thing that the bankers paid. So the bankers basically took the view that they didn't owe anybody anything and they should get everything back. And this, of course, has been the position very frequently of the IMF. Now, sometimes, like in the Brady Plan, okay, the bankers lost about 30%. In Argentina right now, they are threatened with losing 70%, and they're not very happy about it at all, as you can imagine. So my point here would be that in any kind of fiscal crisis of this kind, then we should not be in a situation where it should simply be borrower beware. Lenders should also be beware and recognize that they're going to have to take part of the cost. But what we've seen is, of course, an unwillingness on that part of the current political economic elite to be able to pay anything in relationship to the sort of crisis situation. Now, some of them occasionally get caught, you know, have their money in the wrong place at the wrong time. But by and large, the financial and political elite have been making out like bandits over the last 30 years and consolidating their wealth immensely with very little risk attached. And of course, one of the things that has also occurred has been this transformation in urban governance, so that you have public-private partnerships, which are really structured around the idea that the public takes all of the debt and the private takes all of the profits. And in those situations, you have almost risk-free activities on the part of the affluent elite, the corporations, and the like. So they live in a risk-free environment where the rest of us have to confront all the risks. I think the thing that interested me was there's a lot of attempt to instantiate neoliberal ways of doing things at different levels at different times. For instance, Ronald Reagan, when he was governor of California, attempted to push some degree of neoliberalization in the early 1970s. He didn't get very far, and in fact, if you look at the contracts, the unions and all those kinds of things in California, he didn't get very far because the political climate was such that he couldn't get very far at that level. What happened in the New York fiscal crisis is they found a huge entity, and the New York City budget at that time, by the way, was larger than most developing countries' budgets. And there was great fear in the international community that a New York default would actually so wreck the international financial system that it would bring the whole system down. And in fact, the Chancellor of Germany at the time got on the phone and basically said to President Ford, look, you can't let New York City go bankrupt because it'll destroy the international financial system. So the New York fiscal entity was a huge, huge entity. And I think when you start to say, well, okay, just because it was a municipality, it's not comparable to what might happen in a state. In fact, the New York City government budget was bigger than that of many states in United States, not bigger than California. But this whole idea of neoliberalization later came into California through Proposition 13, which was in 1978 when they passed that, which is sort of an attempt to impose fiscal discipline on California, in this case through public referendum. It was not a coup by financial institutions. It was a public referendum against rising taxes and therefore state expenditures. But again, Ronald Reagan may have been behind it, but it was a social movement of some kind that was behind it. Now, at the national level and internationally, again, you have a situation in the IMF where, if you can believe Stiglitz, in 1982, in the Reagan administration, they restructured all of the personnel of the IMF and they kicked out all the Keynesians. And they brought in all of the monetarists and the neoliberals and the like in 1982. So it was, in effect, a takeover of the IMF in 1982. But that takeover followed something which was very crucial. Because in the first year of the Reagan administration, again, this is where the ideology and the practice of neoliberalism comes into play. In the first year of the Reagan administration, the Reagan administration wanted to defund the IMF. See, the IMF is not a good neoliberal institution. It intervenes. You're not supposed to do that. Supposed to keep out of the way. And actually, there was a resolution by the Republicans in Congress in 1998, I think it was, also to defund the IMF. So a lot of right-wingers and real neoliberals don't like the IMF. They don't like its interventionism. And Reagan and James Baker were prepared to crash the IMF. They didn't for one very simple reason. In 1982, the Mexican debt crisis hit. And exactly the same problem hit the relationship between Mexico and the New York City bankers. If Mexico went under and went into default, the New York City bankers would have lost, Walter Wriston included, would have lost megabucks. So they had to rescue Mexico in order to rescue the New York City bankers. How were they going to do that? Well, they suddenly found a new use for the IMF. And then Baker said, now we can use the IMF for something. And that's when they started to reconstruct the IMF as an agent of neoliberalization. Before that, the IMF had been very active as a monetarist institution, sound money, all those kinds of things. So it had disciplined many countries in the 1960s, even Britain in the 19. But the IMF didn't march into a country and say, you've got to privatize all your industry, or you've got to do this, or you've got to go through all these institutional reforms. It only started to do that in 1982. And the World Bank started to do that in 1982. And that was when those institutions, under the influence of the Reagan administration, who didn't like either of them and were prepared to defund both of them, by the way, the World Bank and the IMF, then turned around and said, okay, we now have a use for them because they're the vehicles through which we can rescue the New York City bankers. And that's what they did. So again, what we see here is certain layers of relations which exist between all of these institutional arrangements. And again, it's an interesting kind of story because these things then feed back. The IMF then goes into Buenos Aires and says Argentina and says you've got to privatize your water or something of that kind. And so those kinds of things happen. Well, it goes into South Africa and says you've got to privatize this or you've got to do that. So these things sort of, but there's a dialectic there. It's not simply from one level to another. There's a grassroots aspect to it which then spills into another direction. And I think that story is a very interesting one, moving across different scales of organization and consolidating power at different scales at different times. And sometimes that power gets challenged at one level, and then gets institutionalized at another level. These are the ways in which it tends to work. And I think we have to think about resistance, by the way, working in the same way. I find it interesting that there are now 124 jurisdictions in the United States that have passed living wage ordinances. And this is a grassroots movement that is that at a local level is beginning to sort of push the whole kind of question of the living standards of many in the population in a different kind of way. So that kind of thing can work also in terms of what the oppositional movement is about.
Thank you. I'm glad you mentioned the living wage campaign in America. I think it's kind of a beacon of hope, actually. I was hoping you could comment a bit more about identity politics and exactly what you mentioned earlier about discourse of human rights, NGOs, etc. Because in 1982, Hungary actually joined the IMF. And I think Hungary has been a model neoliberal state in the heart of Europe, and that cuts across socioeconomic policies throughout the country. And I'm particularly interested in what you mentioned about oppositional movements, about resistance vis-a-vis the Romani minority of Hungary, because foundations like Rockefeller Brothers, Soros Foundation, George Soros Foundation, Andrew W. Mott, these are the philanthropic wings of these huge corporations or investment bankers, many of them. So basically, can you comment a bit perhaps on the contradictions and then also the way forward, if there is a way forward? Because the Romani activists I've spoken to in Hungary will tell you there is no alternative. We have to cooperate with these institutions who are giving us money. So that is, I think, sort of a core question I have. Thank you.
I'm not at all against rights discourses or pursuit of rights. One of the things I tried to do in the book is take what I think is, I hope, a somewhat balanced view of it, in the sense of saying, look, there are certain arguments that can be pushed, particularly because neoliberalism is contradictory about many of these questions. There are certain arguments that can be pushed through rights discourses. And that these arguments are ones which I would certainly support and be willing to support. But you see, there's nothing about neoliberalization that is in any way antagonistic to multiculturalism or minority rights or individual rights and so on. So there's nothing there that is against rights discourses. But one of the difficulties that you run into immediately is as soon as you get into rights discourses, then you invoke judicial proceedings at some point. And as soon as you get into the judiciary, you have all the sorts of problems you have with certain kinds of biases that exist within the judiciary. And you don't have to be a Foucauldian or anything of that kind to be highly suspicious of the role of the judiciary as part of neoliberal governmentality. And I think there's a real critique to be made of how far you can go with rights discourses. And in terms of minority rights, I think it's perfectly understandable that many of the large foundations would be supportive of many of those minority rights. There's nothing particular about them that it seems to me is going to challenge their power. Whereas, if we're talking about union organizing and all the rest of it, then that's a very different story. And I think that one of the things that the left hasn't done a very good job of is articulating its position on rights and multiculturalism and all the rest of it in such a way as to not undermine, it seems to me, what is a crucial aspect of what's going on around us, which is class formation and class reconfiguration and class and the exercise of a pretty naked, raw class power. And we've sort of had the tendency of throwing out the baby with the bathwater and saying, because all of these other issues were not well addressed in, say, Marxian theory or so, or some other form of left discourse, then therefore we throw out the core of what it seems to me the problem is right now, which is this overwhelming exercise of class privilege and class power and the utilization of some pretty draconian tendencies to utilize that power. I mean, I'm very nervous about the fact that the Bush administration doesn't seem to be concerned about the idea of a major financial crisis. And when people like Volcker and even Greenspan in his own way and the IMF economists and all the rest of it say, look, there's a likelihood of a major financial crisis unless the United States changes its policies in the next 2 or 3 years, and the US doesn't change its policies, you've got to say, well, maybe they want a crisis. Because one of the things they learned from Reagan in the early 80s was, if you want to change the economy, you want to change everything, you want to get rid of Medicare, you want to get rid of Social Security, you want to get rid of all those things, then have yourself a damn good crisis and you can do it. And I think they're even prepared to do that. You know, I mean, I'm not saying they're out there planning it or anything. I'm saying they're just not worried by it because they figure they've prepared their own arcs in such a way that they can survive it very well. I mean, and if you ask yourself the question, who benefited from that huge crisis in Southeast Asia in 1997-98? Who benefited from it? And it turns out there's a whole bunch of people who really benefited from it immensely. And a lot of American capital, for example, a lot of Japanese capital. They bought up assets for almost nothing and then sold them later on for a tremendous profit. Because it's a liquidity crisis. It wasn't a real crisis of production. It was a liquidity crisis. They forced a liquidity crisis, forced people into bankruptcy. People sold out at rock bottom prices. And then, you know, and Stiglitz kind of even says, well, you know, the result was that, you know, American corporations could go up, buy things up and then sell them back again at a huge profit. And of course, a lot of money, speculative money at the time, went to Wall Street. So Wall Street benefited immensely from that crisis. So, you know, there's a way in which people benefit from crises. The political elite, both inside and outside of Argentina, benefited hugely from the crisis in Argentina. And as you know, it's interesting. You turn into one of those neoliberal think tanks, and they said, "You know, this was really amounted to bank robbery by the political and economic elites," and that's according to the Ludwig von Mises Institute, you know, which is a neoliberal think tank. Because they see clearly what's going on through these shenanigans, and it is about the reconstruction and consolidation of class power. So it's when you get to that level that it seems to me that you're not going to get very much from the Soros Foundation, or you're not going to get very much from the Rockefellers and all the rest of it. They will, you know, be very good at various other issues like, you know, AIDS and so on, but not on this sort of question.
Someone down here. Yep.
That certainly resonates with me, the business about crises and capital accumulation. But my question is actually on something that you rushed past in your very interesting talk about the historical reversal historically of perhaps 50 years of urban history of where capital was flying out from the centre, the peripheries, and building peripheral cities. At some point in this neoliberal revolution, capital started to flow back into central cities to the exclusion of the suburbs. I just wondered if you could offer some more insight about that, because it seems really quite a historical reversal of what had been happening for 100 years or more.
In New York's case, Manhattan was always crucial. The amount of money locked up in real estate investments in Manhattan was always huge. And the result of this was there's always been an attempt to valorize or revalorize that real estate in Manhattan in ways which are now kind of pretty astronomical. Well, you see the same process here occurring here in London, and you'll see it in many of the other larger cities of the world. So I think that the kind of interest in real estate, and which is a huge sector of the economy, and the construction industry is a huge sector of the economy, and of course that whole kind of complex of developers and city governments and all the rest of it. So I tend to think that the story of suburbanization was always a somewhat limited story, because there was always an attempt to keep the center revitalized. Even in cities like Baltimore, there's an attempt to do that. It wasn't a very successful attempt for many, many years, and now it's beginning to pay off. But it's always paid off by this process that I call sort of feeding the downtown monster. You need one wave of investment to revitalize the next, and so then it gets a momentum of its own. And the result of that is you in a sense, you start paying off your last round of debt by a new round of debt. So this is the way in which urban real estate develops. And I was very intrigued when I was talking about this in China earlier this year to find out that that's how Chinese municipalities work too, that many of the municipalities in China are totally up to their neck in debt. It turns out, I was quite surprised. I thought they were making out very well, but they're not. They're hugely in debt. And you say, well, where's the money coming from? Well, it's from the local banks, you know. So there's a huge kind of indebtedness of all of these municipalities who are actually giving real estate, land, developed land, and all of the things that go with it, you know, water and sewage and all that kind of thing to the large corporations for almost nothing, when it costs them something. And so they're also having to feed their particular monsters. So I think this whole kind of process then picks up. And I think, for instance, in Baltimore, you see it picking up in the 1980s. And by now, it's got to the point where, you know, you need even vaster waves of investment to recuperate what you've already put in. So this is one of the processes that seems to me to be reshaping downtowns. And it's a very simplified version of it, but it's reshaping downtowns in very significant ways, but it's reshaping them in according to a different kind of ethos. I mean, I think there's a case to be made that actually what we're seeing is the suburbanization of the city. I mean, when they start to convert Times Square into a version of Disneyland, actually some of the qualities that make New York a really interesting place suddenly start to try, you know, soon we'll have, you know, the equivalent of suburban shopping malls in the center of the city, and so where will we be? And so this kind of suburbanization of the city is turning the city into a playground for suburbanites, and it's got a suburban culture which is being actually reinserted into the city, which is a very interesting phenomenon in itself.
Right, we have 2 minutes left. Lots of people want to ask questions. We have to stick with the order, so we probably only have time for one more, and it was here.
Yeah, you've used the word neoliberalism many times this evening, but you haven't talked about capitalism particularly as such, which it's quite clear that you don't think that neoliberalism is just capitalism. And I was just wondering if very briefly you could say a little bit about Keynesianism, and because obviously there are aspects of Keynesianism in the United States and Western Europe that I think many of us would see as a more appealing social model in terms of the lower inequality and the rising real wages at the bottom and so on. But nevertheless, I mean, there are plenty of Marxist critiques of Keynesianism as another model of US hegemony in terms of how it fits into the Bretton Woods system and so on. I was just wondering, do you see there's something structurally different about neoliberalism? And is there anything we ought to be trying to sort of rescue about Keynesianism in a sort of normative sense? So sort of, I know, I appreciate it's a very wide question, but you didn't really say very much about Keynesianism, which in a sense kind of knits together in a way.
Well, I tend to prefer to talk about something I call embedded liberalism rather than Keynesianism, which is the idea of a market economy which is surrounded by bunches of regulatory kinds of apparatuses and restraints and public interventions and public directions and so on. So, and there were very different models of that emerged post-World War II. The United States had a particular kind of model of that. Britain had a model of it. France had a model of Sweden. You know, there are different kinds of versions of embedded liberalism. But what neoliberalism tries to do is to disembed. That is, to liberate capital flow from any of those kinds of restraints. But as I've suggested, actual neoliberalism, by insisting upon high levels of state intervention to create a good business climate, actually tends to do the reverse of what embedded liberalism did socially, which is to start to redistribute wealth, as I mentioned, to the corporations rather than and let the, you know, by a system of idea of personal responsibility for your own health care and your education and all the rest of it, to actually put responsibility on the individual for all of those all of those elements. Now, there is an irony about, as I mentioned, about neoliberalism. It's not worked very well in terms of reestablishing the conditions of accumulation, and I think there's some very good reason to it. And we're now actually faced with a situation where the two economies which are powering the global economy right now, i.e. China and the United States, are actually acting through deficit financing. They're deficit financing like crazy. I mean, they're acting like Keynesian, you know, simple Keynesian states. I mean, the U.S. deficit is huge. Borrowing money from the rest of the world, I mean, it's absorbing about half the world's savings. I mean, surpluses of capital from the rest of the world are just flooding into the United States, and the United States has almost no way to pay it off. And one of the things I do in the book is start to talk about, you know, what the consequences are likely to be in the long run, particularly for U.S. Economic and political and even military power. Of that, the fact that they're so, you know, hugely indebted. The Chinese are hugely indebted, but in a different kind of way. I mean, they have all the surpluses, of course, and they're funding the, you know, in terms of foreign exchange. But internally, the debt that exists now, in terms of, I mentioned, you know, municipalities, how much debt they've accumulated. There's about probably half of the loans which are out in the banking system in China are non-performing loans. So there's a huge hidden debt in China. Huge, and if anybody tries to call it due, and one of the big problems for the Chinese is as they try to integrate into the global economy, how the hell are they going to do that? And they're maintaining control of the banks, and they don't know quite how to do it. They occasionally use big dollops of their global surplus to sort of recapitalize their banks. But there's a huge deficit financing going on. I mean, and you know, you're in China, and you become very aware of the fact that they're consuming about half of the world's cement every year. I mean, the amount of construction that's going on. I mean, the five international airports in the Pearl River Delta. And at some point or other, each one of them is going to be a Pacific hub, by the way. And at some point or other, you realize there's a tremendous overproduction going on in China. The capacity of the Chinese auto industry is coming close to 9 million a year. And that's about as much as internal demand can be. And it's about now to start to market in the United States. I mean, the overcapacity in the automobile industry in China, they're going to be able to produce about 20 million cars a year very soon. And who the hell are they going to sell it to? You know, I mean, there's a tremendous kind of overexpansion in China. And so you have these two economies, and everywhere you go, I mean, Argentina has revived a bit in the last couple of years. Why? Because the Chinese came and bought up all their soybeans and all their raw materials and all the rest of it. Chile is doing all right. Why? Because of the Chinese demand for copper. You know, I mean, and actually, most sensible people in Latin America now are reorienting themselves entirely to China. As opposed to the United States. So you've got these two economies that are behaving like Keynesian. I mean, they're Keynesian motors of the whole system, and that's the irony of the thing, you know. We're all supposed to be good neoliberals, you know, but the United States is not behaving like a good neoliberal government at all, nor are the Chinese, and they're the ones who are keeping the global economy afloat right now. So you know, this is the if you like, the real contradiction of neoliberalism. It doesn't work, except for it's redistribution of class power. And that's what it's terrific at. And it's done a fantastic job, and it continues to do a fantastic job. And I suspect that we're going to continue that rhetoric about, you know, the market is going to give us all the answers, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. We're going to continue that forevermore. Because all the while that they control, you know, the media. I mean, you know, what's Rupert Murdoch's Pope is going to say? Are they going to talk about, you know, redistribution of income to the poor? Are they going to talk about that? No, of course not. You know, I mean, I think the Keynesian economics is actually alive and well in terms of actually how things are working, and in a way, it's no surprise when I mention the IMF and the World Bank as Keynesian institutions that were revitalized in a particular kind of neoliberal twist in the 1980s. That there is that continuity which continues. So. Is there any virtue of going back to Keynesian thinking? I actually get my left-wing friends in fury by saying I think actually some sort of limited New Deal right now is not a bad idea, and there's a very simple reason for that. That if there is a global crash of some kind, the number of people who will be hurt is immense, and frankly, I think the bourgeois elites. And their long history is when they've been faced with crashing the system or surrendering some of their power, they've chosen to crash the system. And I think we've got to stop them doing that. And I think the only way to do it is through some sort of collective push towards some kind of new deal, some sort, you know. only as a temporary kind of palliative to make sure there's no massive crash. Because if there's some massive crash, a lot of people are going to be really very, very, very hurt, including, you know, me, you, you know, ordinary people, you know, are going to get really hit with any kind of massive thing. Whereas, you know, like I said, they prepared their arcs. You know, Ted Turner has his big, you know, ranch down in Patagonia to which he can retire and, you know, live off the, you know, steaks forevermore. You know, I mean, they're all right. They'll be okay. We'll be the ones who really suffer. So, I think I'm in favor of that. But it's more like kind of saying, look, can there be some popular movement? And I think some of the stuff happening in Latin America is moving a little bit that way. You know, I mean, some of the elections have gone on in Chile and so on, are moving a little bit that way. And I think, and of course in Bolivia even more so. So I think that there are some real possibilities of supporting that. But of course, you know, my left-wing friends kind of say, well, you're just being a reformist, you know. You kind of say, and then you say, well, the difference between a reformist and a revolutionary is that you made a reformist and revolutionaries can do the same thing at a particular historical moment, but you do it with a different long-term project in mind. But I think right now we need to stabilize this system because it's really out of control.
Well, on that note, I'm afraid our time is up. The only thing remaining to say is that if you now buy a copy of David Harvey's book, which is on sale outside, he will be happy to sign copies sitting here. So for those of you who were excluded from the questions, you can come and ask him by means of exchange.